Support for WPR comes from Worm Farm Institute with the Farm Art Detour, a self-guided excursion through 50 miles of scenic farmland in rural Sauk County, October 5th through the 14th. WormFarmInstitute.org.
Some official role-playing music to get us started today on the show. Larry Mueller here. And why do we have that? Well, 50 years ago, the role-playing game Dungeons and Dragons was created in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. And we'll talk about the legacy of D&D with our guest, Kurt Griesmer. Kurt is manager of K-12 Education Initiatives at the Wisconsin Historical Society. He wrote the feature article titled Dungeon Crawling in Lake Geneva, 50 Years of Dungeons and Dragons. That came out in the fall 2024 issue of the Wisconsin Magazine of History. And Kurt has also developed a Dungeons and Dragons module for kids. It's titled Wisconsin Adventures, and we'll talk about that as well as we move along today. Have you played D&D? What questions do you have about the game? Join the conversation. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Kurt, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Well, 50th anniversary of Dungeons & Dragons. Lake Geneva is where the game was born. Tell us about D&D's origins in Lake Geneva.
Yeah, so Gary Gygax lived there with his family and had been a gamer for many years. And in 1967, he had founded a group like-minded folks, International Federation of War Gamers. And by 68, they had enough people together to rent out a hall and bring everyone together to play games, right? Because these are really, you know, they can be very complicated. There's all sorts of great rules for how you can do this, that, or the other thing. But anyway, people really invest in these, right? And they really like to play them. So they rent out the Horticultural Hall. And that's in 1968, which is the year I was born, so I missed it, you know. But near thing. And a few years later, Gary likes this idea of bringing in mythological figures into wargaming. So rather than just the Teutonic Knights charging forward on a battlefield, what if you threw in wizards like Merlin, right? Or what if you went into the Tolkien legends and pulled out, you know, hobbits and elves and such and brought them into wargaming? And he put out a piece called Chainmail, sort of putting those rules together. And back then, right, everything is either word of mouth or by mail, right? Because, of course, there's no internet, right? And you picked up the phone, you called people, and maybe you didn't even get to leave a message yet because the answer machine
was full or something.
Right? Was full or didn't, no one had one, right?
Yeah.
So, anyway, through the different magazines, the different bulletins that would go out, these newsletters, basically, you know, they put out their rules and say, hey, I'm selling this, you know, what do you have? And people would work on it. And a gentleman named Dave Arneson, a younger guy out of St. Paul, Minnesota, with his own group, right?
Yeah.
Picked up those chainmail rules and really liked them. And he'd been playing, there's a lot of Daves in this story. So he'd been playing another game with another Dave named, and the name of the game was Brownstein. And in that game, it was a war game where you played somebody with a mission. So rather than just running, you know, a standard scenario, you had a mission to do. So you might be the post office manager, right? And you had to get a letter to somebody else on the other side of the battlefield. Or you might be a general, or you might be a soldier, right? So you had all these roles. And Dave really liked playing that game. So he looked at Chainmail and he said, well, cool. What if we take those ideas and make heroes and monsters, right? So we're going to have heroes fighting these monsters, and then I'm going to put them in a dungeon. So Dave Arneson is credited as being the first dungeon master because he takes these ideas, and then he sends his ideas up to Lake Geneva, or down, I suppose, south. We always point down. It's not down, but it's across, right? Anyway, so he gets his ideas to Gary. Gary gets very excited, and his team in Lake Geneva. And I think it's 1973, so it's a few years. They meet in '69 at this convention called Gen Con, which is pretty important to note that that's what it's called. And a few years later, Dave drives with another friend, Dave McGarry, another Dave, a lot of Daves in this story, who created the board game Dungeon, which was a very set, kind of a tabletop game that you would play. And from all of this, Gary Gygax and his team get really excited about playing. Like, they play Dave's game called Blackmore, and they get super excited about it. And Gary says, send me all your stuff, and together we'll knock out this thing. You know, Gary was a shoe cobbler at the time. I'm not 100% certain if he was still working in the insurance industry. He was he had five children to support, and he needed a hit, right? He needed something to catch. And so Dave sent, I think, 18 boxes of things, lots and lots of material. And Gary starts typing, and he sort of codifies all these ideas that Dave has, all the ideas that he's had, puts it all together. And in 1974, along with other people, right? Mike Carr is influential in this, another game designer from back in the day. And together they put out, in 1974, despite Dave Arneson thinking it wasn't quite ready yet, they put out Dungeons & Dragons. And that's the first set. It's a little box set, wood grain box set. And eventually, fairly quickly, it sells out of its first printing, and they have to keep printing it. And that's when they realize that they've really
got something. Mm-hmm. Did they collaborate well?
I don't know that. I never got a chance to meet either one personally. And so there are historians who spend a lot of time, who have spent years working on that relationship. In the end, they did not. They started working together. And I think there was a great quote that I don't think I used in the article, where Dave Arneson said something like, Gary typed faster than I did. You know, but in the 80s, later in 70, what's great about having history, you can look anything up at any time you want. So feel free to correct me, audience, as I stumble through the times. But Gary starts writing a different set of rules that he's going to call Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. And these are some iconic books or hardcover books that come out in the 70s, late 70s. And he's writing these up. And before that, all the copies of Dungeons & Dragons said, you know, Gygax and Arneson, or Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson on them. And when Gary publishes Advances in Dragons, it's Gary Gygax. And he tries to convince people that it's a completely different game than Dungeons & Dragons. Yes. And it goes about that well, and Dave Arneson sues and gets partial credit for the work, but he's out of the company at that point. So he did join TSR at some point in the mid-70s, but I don't know how comfortable their working relationship ever was.
Mm. There's a walking tour of Dungeons & Dragons. It's called The Adventures Map of Lake Geneva.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you see on that tour?
I think that's amazing. So I have not done the tour. I have the map at home. Paul Stormberg created that map. And what I love about Paul's an excellent historian of the game. He's quoted in my article. And I thank all the authors and people who I interviewed and gave me their time to put it together. So that will take you to places where TSR was born, right? So the first location was in the Kay family home. Unfortunately, Kay passed away, and he had invested a lot of money into this little fledgling company, and his widow wanted nothing to do with it and boots Gary and his company out, and it eventually goes in the basement of the Gygax home. So you'll see that where that happens, right? You'll see different locations, and what's great is it's all set up like an old D&D adventure. So it's got the old fonts and sort of the old color schemes from when these are all coming out in the 70s. So it's a great little experience that you can do. You can get the map and you can walk the tour yourself.
You know, back then, how unusual were role-playing games back in the, say, the 70s?
Very, very unusual. So again, just the ideas come out of this. So wargaming has its roots in the Prussian leadership trying to make their generals and commanders better fighters. So Kriegspiel, wargaming, literally, in the 1800s. And adding elements of chance to it, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll roll a die six and see what happens. eventually these become games that need referees to be arbiters of the rules, right? Because if you put a set of rules out that are kind of vague, everyone's going to argue for their side, right?
Like, right.
Well, of course that worked for me. And so they need referees to sort of figure out these rules. But there weren't people, right? You weren't taking on a role until these mission-based ideas started coming up. So there's a game that Mike Carr and Gary and Dave all worked on together before D&D called Don't Give Up the Ship. And even though there's not necessarily roles you can play, it's Napoleonic era, so you could be a general that you happen to know. And you could, and people would, you know, become these admirals and these leaders, right? They started feeling that role happen. And those mission-based games become the birthplace of role-playing games in D&D. So,
wow. So arbiter of the rules, is that a part of the dungeon master's role? Talk about the dungeon master's role.
Sure, absolutely. So so that grows right out of that referee, right?
Yeah.
You're exactly right. So the referee is more or less neutral, right? Looking at both sides and saying, okay, this is how this is going to play out. The DM is not necessarily as neutral. What they're doing is not only do they have an understanding of the rules and help interpret them, they're creating the world, or they're using material that already exists, right?
Yeah.
Because you can buy, of course,
yeah,
anything you want to play the game. But they're the ones who are populating the world with people. There's NPCs, there's monsters, there's weather, there's taverns, there's places to go, there's things to do. And the DM has a grasp on all of that, whether it's a single one-shot adventure, which you're doing in a single night, or a years-long campaign that you're playing with friends in a world that just keeps expanding.
Oh, really interesting to me. We talked to Victor Raymond, a biracial and bisexual Madison man, has a PhD in sociology, and here's what he had to say about D&D, a game he has played since junior high.
The original games themselves were designed by largely, you know, 20-something, 30-something white male gamers in the 1970s, right? In the 1970s. And yeah, I think one of the things, as we've seen each edition come out, there's been an interest in representation. How are people represented? How can they see themselves in the game? That's always been an open question. Certainly anybody who's LGBTQ, they're gonna have to look pretty hard to see themselves represented in the game. And certainly for people of color, that's been a big issue. I have to tell you, the number of people of color who I know who've opened up D&D books that are, you know, more recent, particularly the fifth edition that's been out since 2014, and said, I see myself here. So being able to see oneself in the art, that's a major step forward for people to say, I can now imagine myself playing a character in this game. I can now imagine this world.
That was Victor Raymond of Madison. And it's been criticized as being a game played mostly by young white males, like the people who first created it. Was that was a fair criticism then, and is it now?
Yeah, I think that was a fair criticism. Although my gaming group in the late 70s, early 80s had two young women in it in high school. So we were we were kind of rarefied air there. But yeah, even the original in the Advanced Dungeons & Dragons book, you know, there's charts for all the statistics. One of the things about all your characters, the people you play, they all have strength or intelligence or wisdom. And there's a strength chart that shows that women could not be as strong as men. Right,
like, oh.
That was built into the game from right away. But like Victor had just said there, with fifth edition, Wizards of the Coast, a company that's been publishing D&D now for decades, made a concerted effort to start moving beyond that and really show what the game is capable of being. Right, you should be able to see yourself in that game. You should be able to play the game that you want to play, which I know is very important to Victor, right? The game that you play should reflect what you want to do. Why would you play a game that isn't fun or doesn't show you something about yourself that is, it's fun to do? So, but yeah, it was a fair criticism, but one of the releases just from a few years back has as far as I know, my first experience with a non-binary, non-player character. So a they-them non-player character, which was just kind of awesome and eye-opening and really cool to see. So,
Kurt Griesmer, our guest today, manager of K-12 Education Initiatives at the Wisconsin Historical Society. He wrote an article about the history of D&D, and we're talking with him today. Questions or comments or maybe an experience to share, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org.
Either a weekday or on Saturday, I would walk down to the hobby shop downtown, and that's where Ernie Gygax would be DMing in the basement, and I would go downstairs and play in campaign. And no, he was very proud of his dad, but he was never like, my dad was co-creator of this. He was equally as enthusiastic as Gary in the storytelling and inviting people to play the game. You know, there for a lot of years, there was a lot of weirdness about what exactly this game was and what exactly was happening. But now there's a big embrace in the community, right? They're like, they're working on a statue that's going to be in the park that's going to be Gary with his open hand so that you can roll your dice out of his hand and play at the table with Gary. So these initiatives that are happening in town are very exciting. That was exciting. So it's very nice to see everybody embracing it and celebrating it.
That was Lake Geneva native Sonia Ackright talking about playing D&D as a young girl with the son of Gary Gygax, the game's creator, of course. Ackright is the incoming director of administration for the Geneva Lake Museum, where there's a permanent Dungeons and Dragons exhibit. So really cool. Just to mention, coming up at noon today, we're going to switch gears entirely and talk about the Brewers season that ended last week with Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan, host of Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast. That's at noon today. Right now, though, we're looking at Dungeons and Dragons, and you can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Kurt, nice day. Do you know Sonia?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I met Sonia last year as we were planning the rollout of Wisconsin Adventures Myths and Legends. So
yeah. In the late 70s and 80s, Dungeons and Dragons was condemned by some groups and politicians, if I'm not mistaken. They claimed the game included satanic influences. There were any truth to that claim at all?
No. You know, there's imagery, right? There's demons and devils in the game. They're not the good guys. You know, the heroes are the heroes and the monsters tend to be the monsters. But there's artwork, I'm sure, that they could reference and take a look at. And like anything else that you can misinterpret, if you can misinterpret it and gain some popularity from it, that's probably what was going on. But, you know, a young man, a sad story, but a young man disappears for a while and a private investigator looks into it and pins it on Dungeons and Dragons. This young man played D&D and said, well, obviously he was following in his head a real-life D&D adventure, and that turned out to be completely untrue. He had just gone off the grid, as we'd say today, for a few days. And when he's found, you can't debunk the story, right? The rabbit's out of the hat. A lie travels faster than the truth. And that leads into what's called the Satanic Panic. And, you know, what's the best way to get a teenager to do something?
Yeah, tell him you can't do it.
Yeah, as soon as you say, no, you can't play that game, sales skyrocketed, right? Because suddenly everybody wanted to see what it was about and play the game. I was playing during that time, and my parents asked if that was the game that was in the news, and I said, yes. And that was sort of the end of it. They were just glad I was reading and kind of staying out of trouble. So there's a lot of reading that goes along with Dungeons & Dragons, a ton of great – in fact, there's a ton of great educational skills, which is why – it sort of landed on education to do this out of the Historical Society.
Yeah, and we can talk about that. What have you done as part of that?
Some time back now, everything gets fuzzy. Over a year ago, My supervisor, Abby, came back from a meeting and said, hey, they're talking about the 50th anniversary of D&D. Do you have any ideas? And I said, yes, I do. And I came back the next day with 12 ideas for different adventures based around different ideas in Wisconsin mythology, and quickly realized we could never get all those done in time, and boiled out three of them to create the adventures in Myths and Legends. So we have Night at the Museum, which is an homage to our currently closed museum on the square. And the adventure is actually built on the blueprint of the actual first two floors of the museum, which I will never do again because there's a lot of fake walls in a museum, and you got to draw them all. And then The Hunt for the Hodag, which, of course, based on Hodag mythology coming out of the North Woods. And the last one is The Beast of Bray Road, which is a werewolf myth coming out of the Elkhorn area.
And so kids can play that, and what are they going to learn?
So the very first thing, like I just mentioned, reading is fundamental, right?
Yeah.
It really is to the game. When you open up, in fact, in the 70s, when you would open up that hardcover book, you'd get two solid columns of small text on every page for 150 to 190 pages, interspersed by little bits of black and white art and charts. So you have to know how to read. You have to learn how to read charts. You have to learn how to do basic mathematics, right? You have to be able to multiply, you know, add, subtract, divide, multiply. All of those number skills come into play. And that's just, those are the hard skills, right? Listening to people, learning how to work with people, speaking, public speaking. I get a lot of my public speaking skills from having no fear of talking to my friends about whether we were going to go into the room charging blindly or if we'd sneak in, right? Making plans with other people. A lot of interpersonal skills come into play where if somebody wants to do something else, you have to figure out how you're all going to do the same, you know, how are you going to work together? So there's soft skills that you learn, and there's hard skills that you learn, and they all come together in this role-playing game, which is just a ton of fun. And so it gives agency to the learners, too. So the DM may come up with this world and this scenario and these storylines, and then they get the players involved, and they ruin it because they want to do whatever they want, right? So they might not follow the path that you set up, and as a dungeon master, you're like, ah, and you rolling the dice and trying to figure out what they're going to do next, but you're co-creating that narrative, right? So you're really working together to create this world, this story together. And at the end of the day, unlike the Brewers, there's no end losing scenario, really, right? Even if your character gets eaten by a dragon, you can sometimes come back to life, or you can roll up a new character and try again, right? There's no win-lose forever in Dungeons & Dragons, so...
How long does a typical game last? How many hours?
That's a good question. I had mentioned earlier, one-shots are usually done in an evening. So there's a lot of board games that take longer than a one evening. So if you ever played Monopoly with a sibling and they're taking money out of the bank while you're trying to play. But, you know, 3 to 4 hours for a one-shot adventure where you're doing sort of a one-mission kind of thing and you have characters that are doing only that mission. Where I know friends who have been playing for 30 years together in a single world campaign that keeps evolving and growing. So it really depends. But 4 to 6 hours per session is not unusual.
And I'm wondering how many people, I mean, could one person play it by themselves? What's a sort of a good number of people that it would take?
Yeah, my favorite is 5. So anything between 4 to 6 players and then me running a game, that works out really well for me. People have different levels of being able to handle different groups and how they split off. I remember that I think the first rules, because it comes out of, remember, D&D comes out of wargaming. It's not role-playing, so it's the first real role-playing game. And they have a rule, they have something that says, like, for your first game, limit your table to about 20 players. 12 to 20. I'm like, I don't know how you could do that now, right? The game is very different now. 4 to 6 people who want to play, it seems like that's my particular number, but it's going to be different for every group and every game master, every dungeon master out there. Mm-hmm.
And is it ever played, I would assume it is, via Zoom or Google Meet or something like that?
Yeah, I got a great quote from someone at Roll20, which is one of the online places you can play these. So there's Roll20, there's D&D Beyond, which is the official Wizards of the Coast site. There's all sorts of places that are online tabletop role-playing venues, basically. And during the pandemic, they saw this explosion in growth of online play because it wasn't really safe to get together in person and play the game. And people still wanted to have these social experiences because that's what D&D is. It's a social experience where, you're creating these stories together that you're going to remember forever. Well, mm-hmm. not forever, for a long time. So online became a way of seeing everybody and playing. And so you'll see a map on your screen. There'll still be a dungeon master, you know, running the game. And all of you will be in your little, you'll have your little icons and digital miniatures are going to be up there. So yeah, online gaming really came into its own during the pandemic. And I think the quote is something like they could see actually the spread of the pandemic by the growth in the numbers of people using their online platform.
Interesting. I want to go back to ownership for a minute and just sort of review some of the things you said. TSR is the company Gary Gygax formed to publish D&D books, the modules, other materials. And, of course, the popularity has steadily grown. But the company, you mentioned the company went bankrupt.
Yeah, they functionally went bankrupt in the 90s. And well before that, Gary Gygax had lost control of the company. So Dave Arneson, of course, had basically been shown the door before that. So the founders were all out of the company by the time it went bankrupt in the late 90s, and Wizards of the Coast bought them. They reinvested in the game at that point. They looked and said, okay, well, let's bring this back to what it was. And they spend a lot of time and effort and energy on Dungeons & Dragons, making it what it is. There's different editions. So the first edition, those first hardcover books, we're up to edition 5.5 now. Wizards put out a third edition for sure, and then fourth edition, third, 3.5, fourth, and fifth. But the popularity of the game really took off with fifth edition. And I couldn't tell you the exact reasoning behind why that is, but part of it is the game is easier to play. So fifth mm-hmm. edition, my daughter wanted to learn how to play, and we all dug out our first edition books rather than buy anything new. We were like, okay, my friends and I, we dug out our first edition books and we tried to teach her how to play that. Really complicated stuff. There's things like Thaco and negative mm-hmm. armor classes and all sorts of things. We're like, wow, how did we learn this when we were kids? But fifth edition, when it came out, I bought the starter set. I read through the starter set. I came back to my group and said, we're going to change. Everyone should spend $30 on a player's handbook, and we're going to move over because the game was made easier to play. It was just as exciting. They made it different, but not significantly, not a game you didn't recognize. When you looked at fifth edition, you recognized the roots of the game from where it came from. And yet for my daughter, instead of that learning curve that went sharply up, it was a mellower learning curve that we could all take part in together.
How much money is that company made on?
Millions and millions, right? The interesting about D&D is you can buy one, two, or three books and never buy another thing. So you can create your own adventures. You can create your own worlds. All you need are the basic rules to play. There's the SRD, which, as I said before, it's either system reference document or system resource document. That's available for free online that's compatible with 5th edition. So there's a very... There, you can invest as much or as little as you want. But what really happens is they create modules, so adventures that people can play, right? People will buy those. They'll create character sheets that people can, you know, use. Now you can just download character sheets. They create these online environments like D&D Beyond, where you can pay for a subscription service to play online and have all your books online and all the rules built into systems that help you go. So there's all these mechanisms and avenues for being able to make money off the game. But again, it's something that you don't have to invest in any more than you want to.
Conventions. You did mention conventions. I think in 1967, you mentioned that Gary Gygax started this Lake Geneva gaming convention. I think they referred to it as Gen Con.
Yep. So Gen Con, actually, I think it might be 68, the first Gen Con. The group he forms is 67, the Federation of Wargamers.
Okay.
But I don't think they called that Gen Con 1. Again, if you're out there and you know the answer, I'm happy to listen because But yeah, Gen Con still goes to this day. It went from being too, it got too big to be in Lake Geneva anymore, moved around. I think Platteville had one, to different universities. It ends up in Mecca Arena in Milwaukee for some time. And then gets even, it's huge. And when Wizards of the Coast buys it, their base, they decided to move Gen Con to Indiana, Indianapolis, where it's still run every year today.
And how many? I mean, there's 50, 60,000.
Easily, yeah. Tens of thousands of gamers descend to play the games. And volunteers make the world go round. I'll be running games at the one coming up here, Gamehole Con in Madison. I'll be running games based on the work that I've done for the society. But, you know, that's all time that we, that the DMs just go and say, I'm going to run this game. And the, you've got volunteer organizers saying, great, we're going to put together the players with the gamers. And it all comes together. And I don't, couldn't tell you how it all works, but it just does. It's great.
And it wasn't it, if I'm not mistaken, I mean, there weren't those conventions or many of them before the first one that Gary threw.
Yeah, I don't know the history of gaming conventions across the United States, but I can tell you that in Wisconsin alone, there are now dozens of conventions of all stripes. So you, fandom, which is sort of the general catch-all for everybody who's into these things, is multifaceted, and you can find a convention based on anime series. You can find conventions based on comic books. You can find conventions based on games, which we're talking about today. So there's just dozens just in our state alone in different region, different parts of the state in different sizes, right? But all across the country, all over the world, there's gaming conventions and science fiction conventions and Star Trek conventions and all. It's a lot. It's a lot.
And Gary's the Gary Con is still going in Lake Geneva.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So is there something that sets that apart from other gaming conventions?
One is the legacy of Gary Con and Gary Con Zero. When Gary passed away, I think it's in 2008, his friends gathered together, as he would have, I'm sure, wanted them to play games. And they call that Gary Con Zero now. And they decided, we're just going to do this and make it a thing. And so from that time to today, and I don't know what number they're on. Sorry, I don't have that memorized. But today they've steadily grown. And the 50th anniversary, of course, was huge for them,
yeah,
too. And looking forward to next Gary Con. Just spoke with Josh the other day, and he's excited. I mean, it's a very exciting time to be part of this Dungeons & Dragons experience.
Yeah. You know, we talked to Royce Thigpen, the IT and website director for Gamehole.com. It's a mid-sized fantasy gaming convention taking place in Madison next week. And this is what he had to say.
90% of gaming conventions don't exist if Dungeons & Dragons was never created, right? So our early shows were very much, we're going to be running a D&D con, but we're not going to be exclusively D&D. We're going to have other stuff in. Because most people who play Dungeons & Dragons also play other things. They play board games. They play other role-playing games. So we will be pushing around 7,000 people on site this year.
Amazing. Royce Thigpen talking about the 12th annual Gamehole.com, which is October 17th through the 20th at the Alliant Energy Center in Madison. And again, started by a group of D&D players.
Yeah, yeah.
D&D for kids. Let's go back to that Historical Society, Wisconsin Historical Society game that you developed for kids. You mentioned that one of them is set. Talk about the different settings that people might be involved in.
Sure. It was a lot of fun to work on. The first thing you need is a small village to get started in, right? And I needed a reason for Wisconsin to exist. You don't need... Okay, it's a fantasy game, but why is Wisconsin in this fantasy world? So I looked at some stories of how to get there and settled on the wreck of the Christmas Tree Ship, which is one of the most famous shipwrecks in Wisconsin, which I've heard Tamara Thompson talk about on this show.
Yes.
And so for more information on that, I highly recommend our maritime archaeology team. But I took and did a fantasy spin on that, cracking some sort of magical barrier, and suddenly Wisconsin is now part of this Dungeons and Dragons-esque world. And the place I settled on was our own historic site, Wade House. So the village of Wade comes out of Wade House, because up at Wade House, they've got a blacksmith shop, they have a sawmill, they've got a tavern. You know, it's a very neat little environment to get your party started up. And so the heroes come to Wade. For whatever reasons, the heroes show up in these places, and then they sort of find out the rumors, what's happening. They get recruited right away because there's missing villagers. The villagers have disappeared in the swamp, and in the swamp, there's an ancient place of learning called a museum, and they need to, and there's a missing knight, which is why it's called Knight at the Museum, who also went to try to find the villagers, and that knight never returned, and so she's missing, and the players then have to go find out what happened to everybody, and they have adventures as they get through, and all of it's historically inspired. So to get to the museum through the swamp, they have to travel down an old plank road, right? And because that was a thing, and because plank roads were often private, I have an old rotted toll booth gate at the front that players can investigate and find old coins that say something in "we trust" on them, you know, like, so, but that's all sort of all these little pieces of history that get that are baked into what I know about Wisconsin, and what I was able to research was so much fun to put into this. So, again, it's a little homage to our own museum that is currently closed as we build a new Wisconsin History Center, which will be open in a couple of years. And we're really looking forward to that, because it's going to be fantastic. But a lot of love for that old building that we all kind of hung together with duct tape and baling wire, sometimes literally. And so kids, when they play, again, it's not hitting them over the head with the hammer of education, right? We're not testing them on whether they remember anything from the module. But when they rescue the knight, the knight's name happens to be Bell the Crazed. And Bell the Crazed comes from the fact that the word follies translates from the French as the crazies. And Belle La Follette is a historic figure in Wisconsin. So Belle the Crazed is a knight doing the best she can to be good and, you know, take out the bad guys, and the players have to rescue the knight. You know,
It sounds fascinating. Kurt Griesmer, our guest today, manager of K-12 education initiatives at the Wisconsin Historical Society. It's great to have him with us. He's written about the history of Dungeons and Dragons. It's great to have him with us. I hope you'll join in. Questions or comments, maybe have you ever played? I'd love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.
Being in a D&D environment and playing the game with friends, it is improvisational theater of the mind. You know, you are playing together to create this shared story, and you get to have a funny voice, and you get to invent dialogue for a character that was, you know, a paragraph thumbnail sketch in a book. And sometimes those can be powerful and profound and meaningful, as well as fun and fun.
That was Ben Klepczyk, Director of Integrated Marketing and Communications for the University of Wisconsin Memorial Union, and a Dungeons and Dragons player. He started in middle school and now, I guess, quit for a while and now again restarted as an adult. Just a quick mention, tomorrow on the show we'll talk with a registered nurse about misinformation and misconceptions around surrounding clinical trials, and then we'll learn about lung and pancreas transplants. That's tomorrow on the show. Right now, we're talking Dungeons and Dragons with our guest, Kurt Griesmer, manager of K-12 education initiatives at the Wisconsin Historical Society. Give a call if questions or comments. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. You have the mythical Hodag involved in one of the creations that you developed.
Yeah, the second adventure. So D&D is based on your character getting better at what they do. Right, and that's part of the emotional investment in the game. As your character gets better at what they do, you get more powers, more skills, more spells. It just becomes a more complex and rewarding experience. So after you finish Night at the Museum, you level up to level 2. Woo! And you go at level 2 on this Hunt for the Hodag mission. And the Hodag most likely comes from oral traditions of indigenous people telling their stories to the lumberjacks and loggers up north. And one of those loggers, Eugene Shepherd, heard that and thought, cool. How can I make some money off of this? And he and his buddy Luke Kearney, they create a large, you know, probably papier-mâché wires hodag. And they invent a mythology around it, like it drinks only the blood of white bulldogs by the light of the full moon and all this, all these things. And they put it in the dark. They're going to have it at the Oneida County Fair. They're going to charge a nickel or a dime to see the ferocious beast. You know, they get photo shoots taken of it, like with this hodag with its foot resting on a child in the woods like this. And they're all surrounding it with their rifles. And, you know, they have a lot of fun with this hodag idea of this hoax. And eventually they're kind of caught out. I want to say that someone, some scientists from New York were really excited about this new creature they had found. And they're like, oh, no, wait. So, but they had a lot of fun with the idea. It wasn't his only thing that he did, but it was one of the coolest things. And so in Hunt for the Hodag, players are told about this, you know, something's killing the livestock and they have to go figure out what it is. And they go track down this field and they find this weird burn spot that smells kind of like, you know, cooking oil. And so there's elements of a hoax, but it could be a real dragon. It could be anything. And they go and fight some bandits. I've got my friend's bulldog in there. One of my favorite parts of his bulldog Servo's in there. And Servo's superpower is knocking you down and slobbering all over you. And anyway, the players eventually discover, sorry if you're going to play it, and this is a spoiler, they discover that it's two bandits inside of a costume causing all sorts of trouble. And eventually you confront Eugene Shepherd and try to stop him from his plans of mutton domination. So, and yeah, we had a lot of fun with it. We did a live action version of it here in Madison on Gary Gygax Day. So a celebration of Gary's birthday. And we worked with BID to create a live action version. So all the participating businesses, we had volunteers with dice. And you had to roll the dice and beat a certain number. And if you got higher than the number, you got the real truth. What was really going on? You got a clue. But if you got a low number, you got mythology. So you got a lie. And then it ended at our building where they got to confront. We have our own papier-mâché hodag that our graphic designer once built for us. And we hit it in the auditorium with lights and roaring sound effects and all sorts of things. And then people would come and roll the big foam die and see if they beat the hodag. And we've got great photos, like a little girl who throws a die up in there. She's like, just staring at the die that's flying through the air, and a whole group of people dressed as adventurers all have their hand on the die before they roll it, hoping to beat the hodag. So it's been a lot of fun.
So I'm wondering, could these be played in classrooms?
Yeah, it would be tough to do for a whole classroom, but I have, you know, teachers are some of the most creative and inventive people out there. And one educator came up to me last year and said, you know, I don't have the time to do the whole game in my room, but what we're going to do instead, because I love this idea, we're going to do character development based on Dungeons & Dragons character types. So you can be a heroic fighter, you could be a sneaky rogue, you could be a spellcaster, a sorcerer, a cleric who's a healer. And we're going to develop characters that way, and all the kids are going to create their own narrative of why they're a hero. You know, what was their backstory? You know, why did they decide to become adventurers? And then eventually, anyone who wanted to play, they'd form a D&D club. Because again, D&D is very people intensive to play. One dungeon master can only handle so many people to play. But a D&D club where you have many dungeon masters coming together, if you have a group that wants to do it, and of course, there's ways to modify the game. And again, I leave it to educators who are some of the most phenomenal, creative people with, again, you give them a paper clip and tape and your child knows how to read and write, and, you know, so.
That's an amazing, and you've got a third one, so we've got to go talk about the third version.
Yeah, so the third adventure in there is The Beast of Bray Road, and it's a kind of a classic werewolf story. And what I did was never have the actual Wade of Wade House or Wade's Inn in the story. He was always missing. Mm-hmm. And so he's disappeared, and the person running the Wade Tavern, comes up and asks you to go find Wade. And it turns out Wade has been cursed with lycanthropy. And it's a whole convoluted storyline that deals with a lot of little Wisconsin pieces. It's been was a lot of fun to put together. For instance, to cure it. In fact, you don't do any of these things on their own. So one of my coworkers, Michael, I said, Michael, I'm trying to figure out a way to tie together the cure for being a werewolf with Wisconsin history. And he came up with the doctor's name who was the first one to save somebody's life who had full-blown rabies. And that doctor's from Wisconsin. So we, Yeah, so we used that protocol, the you know, a version of the name of that protocol, which is escaping me now, even though it's written down and I've seen it hundreds of times over the last year and a half, as part of the cure for the Beast of Bray Road. So there's a lot of ways not to kill things in my module. That was one of the knocks on it from a professional writer. There's a lot of ways not to kill things, but, you know, you want kids to think outside the box. You want them to think of ways to solve problems. You know, that's the whole goal. So
Gary Gygax, when did he pass away? It's been...
I think it's 2008. I'd have to look it up to be sure.
You kind of wonder what goes through his mind, because he would have experienced almost from afar. I mean, he started it, or mm-hmm. one of the two people who started it, but he would have experienced its growth.
Yeah, he went through the highs and lows, right, of his own company and watch. He was instrumental in getting the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon made in the 80s. You know, D&D, they were branching out into all these areas, whether they were completely successful or not. There was a vision that this was bigger than just the game, you know, getting incredibly talented authors to write full-blown fantasy novels based on Dungeons and Dragons characters, right, or characters that might be in the worlds. Gary would have... I don't know. Again, I don't know him personally. And Ernie is still... Ernie Gygax is still around to ask. Luke Gygax, who I met at GaryCon last year, incredibly kind with his time. These, you know, they knew Gary, but I can imagine that seeing the way that people still play the game and love it, I think that would have been really gratifying for him.
Yeah,
you know,
I think you hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you kind of hope so. I couldn't believe he got canned from the company. I don't even know how you would get fired from the company that you...
Yeah, just something about shares, you know. different people had so many shares of the company, and eventually enough people who didn't want Gary part of the company owned more shares together than he held individually of that company. So...
So, I guess the story for that is, if you want to keep in the company, you need to keep 51%?
51%, right. But, of course, it's difficult because it takes a lot of money to make these things. So you need more investors. You need people to come in and feel ownership of it, right? You can sort of watch the path that everything's following. But history is great that way. You can see what happened, but predicting the future is a lot harder.
Yeah, so. it is indeed. Do you think there's more to come with it? Are there new variations?
Yeah, so Wizards of the Coast, they just put out version 5.5 this year. The New Player's Handbook is out. We're working on our second module. The title currently is Nightmare Over the Dells, so it's going to be centered around the Baraboo area, and that'll come out next year for... again, like that leveling up concept. So at the end of Wisconsin Adventures, Myths and Legends, you're level 5, and then you're ready for the next set of challenges then in the next iteration of the Wisconsin Historical Society's adventures.
And Patty had emailed wondering about that. Where does she find more information about those? She's got a 6-year-old grandson.
Yeah, so... you can find it online, so wisconsinhistory.org, and then we have our store online, which I believe is shopwisconsinhistory.org, but I'm sure that our team has it, so you can click right on the word shop and get there. And that's where, and we also have an informational website just about Wisconsin Adventures and why we created it and what's all available.
This has been fascinating, Kurt. I want to thank you so much for telling us the history of Dungeons and Dragons. And I hope we have a chance to talk again. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It's been my pleasure. I really appreciated it.
Kurt Griesmer, manager of K-12 Education Initiatives at Wisconsin Historical Society. It was great to have him with us. And it was fun to learn, for me to learn about Dungeons and Dragons. I've never played it, but it was fun to hear about it. And it sounds like there's some excitement to come for our youngsters here in the state. Coming up, a look at the Milwaukee Brewers. I'm Larry Mueller.
3-1 to Alonso. Williams sets. Here's the pitch. Swinging a fly ball to right field. Pretty well hit. Frelick back at the wall. He jumps. It's gone. He did it. He did it. Pete Alonso with the most memorable home run of his career. Pumps his fist as he rounds second. It's a three-run homer. He's given the
Molitor and Yount through a baseball. Thomas hits him out. Gentle band.
We had to get a little music in there to get that terrible sound out of our ears from Howie Rose's announcing the WCBS from WCBS Pete Alonso home run. And what can you say? Well, we're going to find out what can be said. We've got a couple of guests on the show. Great to have them back. Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan. Ryan, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having us back, Larry.
Yeah.
We're happy to be here, even if it's not the greatest of circumstances.
Yep. Paul Noonan, it's not the greatest of circumstances, is it?
Nope. And it isn't for, you know, most of the other baseball teams' fans either, but alas.
Yeah. Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan host Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast. And we'll talk with them about the highs of the regular season, the lows of the postseason, and what maybe to expect next season. We can also take a look at what, you know, the teams that are left and what's going on there. I think there's a couple of exciting things to talk about there as well. And I hope you'll join in. What are your thoughts about the Brewers season? Were you at that last game or did you watch it on TV? How did you respond to that terrible ending for us? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. Have you guys recovered from this? Paul, start with you.
So I'm kind of what I like to call a bad sports fan. I recover from losses very, very quickly. I think my life's actually a little bit better than a lot of people's because of it, because I actually really enjoy the happy stuff that happens, but after 24 hours, I'm good to go. I'm on to football season. So I know people live and die with it. A lot of my relatives do. A lot of my friends do. But I was really mad for 8 hours, and I'm good now.
Ryan, what about you?
Yeah, I'm basically over it at this point. I started looking forward pretty much right away because this is a good young team with lots of stuff to talk about for the future. So I was able to kind of say, okay, that was that. But this one was just such a level of horrifying that we haven't seen in at least 40 years that this has been a tough one to swallow. I think that was the worst sporting event, the most disappointed I've ever been walking out of a sporting event. It was pretty surreal, actually, in a lot of ways. There were Mets fans behind me who were whispering because they didn't want to like upset the herd of all the disappointed solemn Brewer fans proceeding out. They were like keeping their voices down and trying not to be loud and boisterous. I'm sure that wasn't Mets fans all over the place. I'm sure there were Mets fans who were taunting and whatever, but the ones who were behind me on the stairs were doing that. And I'm like, I've never seen anything like that before. I'm used to you leave that park after a Cubs loss and you're used to being taunted by Cubs fans. This was a level of horrifying that I think Mets fans have like some familiarity with. So I think maybe there was a little bit of respect there, but it was pretty wild.
I was watching the game on television. I wasn't at the game, and they showed the Mets stadium. I think it was the Mets stadium. They showed the fans when that home after that home run. And they were boisterous. They were really boisterous.
Oh yeah, well, they had nothing to fear. So that's all the difference.
So on a quick recap of that game, you know, we had Tobias Myers pitch just, what, five, was it five? Five great innings.
Yes.
And then we bring in three relievers who just were lights out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and this is the way the Brewers have done things all year. And with Tobias Myers in particular, I know I saw some fans wanting to keep him in. He did pitch brilliantly, and he pitched brilliantly for a lot of the season. But he is, like a lot of Brewers starters, significantly worse the third time through the order. And I'll get to some of my criticisms of this game later, which Ryan has fewer than I do, I think. But that's how you should manage in an elimination game, is don't take any chances. Don't futz around with a guy just because you're feeling like he might be good. And Tobias Myers, I think, has something like an 828 OPS against the third time through the order versus like 600 the rest of the time. And so this is what you should do with him. You should pull him after that. You should say, good game. Go hit the showers. We'll pick it up for you. And, you know, until the very last part of the ninth inning, that worked brilliantly. But that is why they did it. We have a ton of metrics on him, and you don't want to let him go too long. That's when he starts to get into trouble.
Yeah, especially with Lindor looming as the leadoff hitter for that third time through the order.
Yep.
And he was the next batter when Myers got pulled. And I know there was griping, but I was 100% with it. Just like I was 100% with it when they pulled Devin Williams in game one as well, because we'd seen that movie before. And so, or I'm sorry, not Devin Williams, Freddie Peralta.
Freddie Peralta. My
guys mixed up here. But yeah, when they pulled Freddie Peralta in game one, that was also a controversial thing. And that was the big inning that sunk them happened right after that. And so that was pretty controversial. But this is a thing, a longstanding trend with Tobias Myers, that you don't want to take it too far. And in a game where it was tied at 0-0 at that point, every single thing was going to matter. They couldn't afford to give any ground. They couldn't afford to have Myers throw one bad pitch to Francisco Lindor and have it go over the wall. So they pulled him earlier than I think a lot of people would have liked, but it was very shut down from McGill, who pitched the sixth. It was McGill, and then it was
Mears,
which was a total surprise. Yeah, Mears coming in. You were going, oh, how is this going to work? Because he'd been kind of a home run machine.
Yeah, he had.
And so when Mears comes in for the seventh, you're kind of wondering about that. Then we all had a ton of questions about Freddie Peralta pitching out of in relief in the eighth inning. And that went brilliantly. That was 1-2-3. That was that he absolutely shut them down. And so at that point, you have set up one of the best closers of all time in Devin Williams. I was just listening to another podcast, Effectively Wild. They were talking about the fact that, you know, by a thing that looks at how many runs you allow relative to your era and relative to your park and all of those things, Devin Williams has the second best for relievers who've pitched at least 200 innings in their careers. He is the second best behind only Emmanuel Clase, who's still alive pitching for the Guardians in this postseason. But they're actually ahead of Mariano Rivera. Both of those guys are ahead of Mariano Rivera in terms of runs prevented. Devin Williams is the guy you want in this situation. He is one of the best of all time, and he blew it. And that's going to be a hard thing to just live down for a while here. You set up the situation you wanted, and it went poorly.
Yeah, it did indeed. I was really nervous right away when he had that first walk. I thought, uh-oh, because he doesn't usually walk a lot of people, or anybody for that matter. I thought, you know, okay, that's bad. And then he gets an out, and then a single, or I forget the order of that.
Yeah, that's right.
Gets an out, and then a single, and then Pete Alonso comes up, I think.
Yeah. And that is exactly right, and Pete went the other way and took him deep, and it was a weird bit of circumstance there. In that, so in a vacuum, Williams is a fine choice to pitch to Pete Alonso. You have the platoon advantage. there are just a couple little specific things that came back to bite them. One of which is that Pete Alonso is actually one of the best opposite field hitters that exists, especially for power. He hit that ball out to the opposite field. The Brewer picnic area came back to bite him a little bit there. That was unfortunate. And Williams did not locate that pitch super well, given that Alonso is good at that specific thing. I'm not sure he was thinking about it necessarily, but, you know, is what it is. That's what the, what he's good at. Righties never take Devin Williams deep. It just doesn't happen very often. And so there's definitely a lot of bad luck baked into that. There's also, of course, Pete Alonso is a very, very good hitter. And sometimes good hitters just have the ability to turn it on in the playoffs. But I would say the couple of at-bats before him were at least a little bit worrying. The walk in particular, Nimmo, singles sometimes happen too. So there weren't like super huge alarm bells. But this was when Devin has trouble, it sometimes does look a little bit like this. And I do wish they would have at least had. So this is an elimination game. And while Williams is your guy in a regular season game, you let him go. You let him work through stuff. I wish they would have at least had guys up in the pen just because of the magnitude of this game. If I'm managing the ninth inning of an elimination playoff game, I am always having people ready to go in the bullpen, regardless of the situation, regardless of how good my closer is, because if he starts to get into trouble, you can pull somebody for the platoon advantage. Or one of the other things about Devin Williams is his best pitch is a changeup. And I don't know how much this played into the course of the game, but that is also Tobias Meyer's best pitch. They both lean on, they're not quite the same pitch. Airbender's a little different, but they've seen a lot of that in this game. And sometimes you just need a guy to come in and throw 100 and change things up and blow people away too. So I would like to see them just have a little bit more preparedness in the ninth, but Williams is, of course, like the best closer of all time. So is what it is. Tip your cap sometimes.
Yeah, go ahead, Ryan. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say that, yeah, it was a tough situation, and they could have definitely had somebody warming, but I don't think you were going to pull Williams in that situation, because this is something we've seen from Williams. We actually have kind of been joking about it on the show for a while now, that he was sort of turning into a little bit of a mini version of 30 Pitches of Terror, which was the nickname for Francisco Rodriguez, who used to be the Brewers closer about a decade ago now. And those were hallmarked by some really long, terrible outings. Devin isn't to that level yet where he struggles and you really watch him sort of melt down, but he has bad outings, and he had some bad outings this year where you could see him walking multiple guys, hitting a batter, and you could sort of see the trouble. But the thing was, he would often wiggle out of those situations too, because he's very, very good at getting the big strikeout when he needs it. And so that was sort of the expectation I had sitting there, was, well, he's going to figure a way to get out of this, especially because he had the platoon advantage on Alonso. I immediately, sitting there in the stadium, said, okay, I wasn't even really worried about Alonso. I was worried they were going to pinch hit, because I think they had Iglesias, who's another right-hander, hitting behind Alonso. I assumed they were going to pinch hit Jesse Winker for him, and then we would get the lefty. And that was kind of when I was going to get nervous. So when that home run happened, that was the part that kind of took me by surprise.
Yeah,
and it took everybody by surprise. Nobody was expecting that outcome. So, but yeah, I wouldn't have pulled him, but having somebody up and warming, that certainly makes sense.
Yeah, it does indeed. Jim and Ephraim emailed wondering, what do you guys think? Could Murphy, or maybe should he, have left Peralta in for the ninth inning? He looked so strong in the inning before. I would preface that by saying, you know, he's often in this first inning. When he first went in, I shuddered almost, because he has usually a bad first inning if he's going to have a bad inning. But what about Jim's comment?
I'm not sure. So it was such a weird move in the first place. And I'm not sure how to, like, put any kind of scientific rigor to leaving Freddie in for two consecutive innings there. The bottom line is that there was no chance that they were going to do anything other than go to Williams in the ninth. And whether there may be some background statistics that indicate that was right or wrong, because like the way that we use closers is not optimal in baseball. It's based on a save rule that is kind of nonsensical. And in the playoffs, you should frankly ignore it. Like if they thought Freddie could burn through another, even if not the whole inning, like it had kicked off and do okay, that would have been fine. But it was such a weird, like of all the things I disagreed with in the game, putting in Freddie Peralta randomly in the middle of it was probably on the high list. And the fact that it worked out is more along the lines of like, well, tip your cap to the Brewers for understanding what they've got there, maybe getting Freddie some confidence and also knowing it's his throw day, he can maybe get through this okay. But I don't think you can make like a really solid argument that he should have stayed in because it was so weird in the first place.
Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan, hosts of the Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast, our guest. Questions, comments for him, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at the Milwaukee Brewers on the show right now with our two guests, Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan, hosts of the Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast. It's great to have them back. And certainly if you have a question or comment, maybe an experience relating to the Brewers, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Paul, you said you had some, well, you mentioned a couple of the complaints that you had about the game itself, but talk a bit, were there other things that were on your mind relating to how that game played out?
The rest of the game, I think, went by and large okay. Just in the ninth, I would have had a shorter leash than I think almost anybody else would have. Devin's good, but Devin has had actually trouble in playoff games in the past, and this was his second time pitching on a back to back, which Ryan will bring up in a bit. We can argue about it, but in this scenario, pitching 2 days in a row, he sometimes has issues, and so I think if I had been managing this, I would have had people up, and I would have been really tempted to go to the pen. Now, I still think I maybe would have still lost the game if I was managing it because I don't think I would have pulled him against Alonzo with the platoon advantage. I wish he would have made it a little more obvious that he was going to struggle by either making it one more batter or not giving up that hit to Nimmo, but walking him. Two walks and I'd have pulled him for sure. A single, I think I let go. But I do wish they would have been a little more aggressive on the ninth just because in situations where it is do or die, you can't mess around. It's just and I don't like closers in the first place. I don't like the fact that they exist. And I think Devin was showing some signs of struggling.
Yeah. Ryan?
Yeah. So the thing about the back-to-backs is a little bit interesting because that immediately went around Brewer's Twitter is essentially right away that he has struggled in back-to-backs. But the problem is that it was such a small sample size. We were talking about five games going into that night this year where he had pitched on back-to-back nights, and three of those five games he had been 1-2-3 in those innings. So he got into trouble in one of them, but like I was talking about, he wiggled off the hook in one of those games on August 31st. He wiggled off the hook. It was the one game against the Cardinals on August 21st where it all blew up in his face. He had three walks. He had a hit by pitch. He gave up a hit. He ended up giving up two earned runs and ended up kicking away the game there against the Cardinals in, you know, a pretty big game in the season at that point, though it ended up not really mattering. The Brewers ran away with the division. So how much you want to put onto that one game, those two games on the 21st and 31st, I have a hard time putting too much stake in that. Like I said, I agree with Paul. The idea of having somebody up isn't harmful, but it was a little bit weird in that they had Joe Ross, and Joe Ross ended up replacing Devin Williams in that game, another right-hander. And I think the thing to have done there, and if you want to criticize, was he didn't have a lefty up, and he could have had Jared Koenig, who's been very good. He could have had Jared Koenig up as a if it got to the situation where we were talking about where they got to the fifth batter, there were two outs, and you had Jesse Winker pinch hit for. I still don't think Murphy would have pulled Williams. I don't think he would have. I don't think most managers would have. But that would be where you'd have a little bit more wiggle room to, like, say, well, okay, you can get the platoon advantage here and potentially end the game. And, yes, Devin is going to be unhappy. Yes, it's going to be unorthodox. But I think that could have been more of a move. But Murphy didn't even – as far as I remember, I don't remember seeing Koenig ever warming.
He did not.
So, yeah.
And I will say – so you're right. It was a small sample size. There were only five back-to-backs all year, and he only struggled debatably in two of them. And the only thing I would say with that is he basically – outside of when he first came back off of the injured list, when he did struggle one other time against Atlanta on August 7th, he really only struggled on back-to-backs. And that's why I would have been at least a little cautious there, is it was one of the only situations that happened all year where he really got himself into any kind of serious trouble. This ended up not mattering, but not pulling him and allowing him to give up the fourth run, I think, was also not the greatest managing.
Yeah.
Because we didn't know that at the time. Being down by one is a lot better than being down by two. It could even have impacted how they played the rest of the game. Having to score two runs is a lot more difficult than having to score one run. So I also think that he managed that portion very poorly. He let him plunk Winker when he came up. I definitely would have yanked Devin after he got down, for sure.
Well, Winker got plunked twice in the game. And I was interesting. I saw a little piece from one of the New York papers that said that Adames did go out to the parking lot. Apparently, the game before, they had some words, and there were words back and forth, and so Winker was getting booed very loudly every time he got up to the plate. But apparently, they had decided they were going to meet in the parking lot after that third game, and Adames did show up, but Winker didn't. And I'm sure Adames said he showed up, but there was no sign of Jesse Winker anywhere. And I'm sure if Winker had wanted to go, the Mets probably would have held him back and not let him go out there to suddenly, you know, get his eye blackened or whatever.
Winker's whole history with the Brewers is obviously it's a wild ride from them bringing him in to start last year and hoping that they were going to get a bounce back from what he had been the year before, and then having an absolutely miserable year, basically disappearing from the roster for the last almost half of the season, and then showing back up on the playoff roster to come in and pinch hit in two late game situations where he got booed, which is the first time I'd ever seen, like, preemptively booing your own player. I'd never seen that before. And I think people could argue it was more booing Craig Counsell for using him there. There's no love lost there, to say the least. There was actually an incident. I happened to be sitting very close to the field on Friday night because the Brewers were playing the Mets the last series of the year. Their last series of the year, they had to still go to Atlanta at that point. And Jesse Winker got plunked on Friday night. And when he leaned down to take off his shin guard, and he took it right on the keister. And when he turned around, when he was leaning down to take off his guard, he looked at the Brewers dugout, had words for them, and basically kind of said, yeah, I know what you just did to me. I know that was on purpose. And so when he had the chance to stick it to them when he was running around the bases on Tuesday night, when he hit the bases clearing triple to, you know, help the Mets the lead and ultimately that they wouldn't relinquish in game one, he was yapping very loudly at what looked like a very surprised Willie Adames, right? Willie didn't seem to recognize what exactly was going on there. He didn't feel that was warranted, but yeah, it was some great drama, some great TV. It just stinks when you're on the losing end of it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Richard in Madison's got something for us. Richard, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes. I am a devoted baseball fan. I've been so for many years. I love the Brewers. I love the game. But there's one thing about the game of baseball that really bothers me. In every other major sport, football, basketball, hockey, when a team wins a big game, they don't just celebrate, but they go and they shake hands with a losing team. They show sportsmanship. It's only in baseball that the team dances around on the field and leaves the unfortunate losers to sit there morose, staring at it all. Nobody comes over to shake hands with them. Can that ever be changed?
You think that's ever going to be changed?
Nah, I really don't. I think it's culturally built into all of those sports. I mean, hockey, it's very much of a, yeah, we beat each other to death and then shake hands afterwards, and I kind of get that one more than anything else. Baseball, I think it's just more, it's too many games, and for a lot of guys, it really is like more their job than it is anything else. And they're there to play the game, and afterwards, you know, in a, especially during a regular season game, you're just going to sleep. You're going home. You're not interested in, you're shaking hands with those guys like every night if you do that. That's a lot of handshaking. I don't think that ever changes. And I don't think, honestly, this is just, people will have different opinions on this. I do not care what the players do with each other after the game at all, shaking hands or not.
Richard, thank you for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@WPR.org. Take a look at the season as well. I mean, if I'm remembering correctly, the Brewers were only out of first place 17 games.
Yeah, it wasn't many.
The whole year. And Jeff is wondering, did not having, well, not having meaningful games down the stretch hurt the Brewers?
That's always a tough one to try to assess. I think they were playing fairly well down the stretch. They had a brief period sort of early to mid-September where they seemed to have a little bit of a lull, and they reeled off some losses kind of right around the time they were getting close to clinching. But then they, down the stretch, they took two of three from the Mets in the last series. In the second to last series, they took two of three from the Pirates. They were playing relatively well at the very end there. They had that wild comeback on the second to last Sunday of the year against Arizona, where they were down eight runs and then ended up winning 10-9. And so I don't think that's what this is. I don't think that's the thing here. It does feel like it's sometimes that's what happens, but there have been a lot of studies on this trying to figure out, is it better to come into the postseason rested? Is it better to come in basically hot, like you were playing a bunch of games that you had to win? And there doesn't seem to be much of a rhyme or reason to it, because it's baseball and there's just too many different things that can happen in any one game that there's a certain amount of randomness to baseball that there isn't in some other sports.
Yeah, if you want to look at what the Brewers might have as sort of a flawed approach to the playoffs, it's far more likely that just that they're so based on depth as a team, that the Brewers' big strengths are bullpen depth and defense. And they have some stars, like Jackson Chourio is turning into a star. Willy Adames is very good. William Contreras is very good. But in a short series, a three-game series, even a five-gamer, but a three-game for sure, the depth of your bullpen doesn't matter as much. And having like five top-tier hitters matters a lot more, just because, you know, you will lean on those guys more than you might during the regular season. You're not giving them random days off in the playoffs. This is all hands on deck. And when you construct your team through depth, you are at least a slight disadvantage via that strategy in that short series that comes up and bites you every year. So I don't think it's anything by having to be steeled in the regular season by playing more important games. A lot of it's luck, and a lot of it is just eventually you run into big money teams like the Phillies and the Dodgers and the Mets, and they often have just better offenses, especially than us. And while they sometimes don't have as good a bullpen, especially on the backside, you don't have to go into the bullpens that deeply in the playoffs as much.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking about that series. Arizona. I was glad that the Brewers didn't have to play Arizona.
Yep.
And
we all were.
The Mets. The Brewers beat the Mets 5 out of 6 games in the regular season, 5 out of 6 times. So that was really hopeful. Made me hopeful. But then you look at the vets, the veterans in that three-game series did not hit hardly at all. Hoskins didn't get a hit. Rhys Hoskins, I don't think. And Willie Adames might have had one hit. And Contreras had maybe one or two hits. So, I mean, those three resulted in, I think, three hits total in those three games. And that was really a killer. It was the younger guys that actually showed up better.
Well, Jackson Churio was absolutely amazing. That game two performance from him where he hits the leadoff homer to start the game and then hits the game-tying home run. Well, both were game-tying home runs. Hits yep. the game-tying home run then in the, was it the eighth? Were just moments that are going to live with me forever. And that second game felt like such an exorcism of so many demons that the Brewers have dealt with in the postseason for so long. And Garrett Mitchell coming in then and hitting another really improbable home run yep. that we weren't expecting. And then, you know, speaking of improbable home runs, you had Jake Bowers, who's been a pretty mediocre guy that we've sort of been joking on the podcast all year that Jake Bowers is exactly the kind of guy who's going to hit a big home run in the postseason out of yep. nowhere, because that's just what guys like Jake Bowers do, and it's baseball. But the one that followed that, certainly, I'll let Paul talk about this, Sal yeah. Frelick's home run that gave them that two-run lead, the back-to-back home runs, and he smoked that baseball. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, that was the hardest hit ball he had all season.
It was 109 mile an hour exit velocity. Just for context, during the regular season, Statcast Baseball Savant tracks everybody's exit velocity, how hard they hit balls on a regular basis, and Sal Frelick was last. He was the weakest hitter in baseball. Now he would still get hits. He'd hit, you know, line drive singles, and he's fast and stuff like that. But nobody hit the ball less hard than him. And so he gets up in the playoffs, and yeah, he absolutely tanked that home run. It was 109 mile exit velocity, about 26 miles an hour harder than he hits balls usually. That was the most surprising thing that happened all playoffs and that will happen all playoffs. So, I mean, the guys who came through for them, you're right, are not their stars at all. If you want to have one criticism that you might be able to level against the team as well, and, early in the season, and we've kind of forgot about this narrative, early in the season, though, both William Contreras and Willie Adames basically demanded that they stop having as many days off. And it's not like they got no days off, but I think especially in the case of William Contreras, you could argue he maybe should have had more days off. He actually had a bad knee in the playoffs. As Pat Murphy likes to say, he had a scratchy knee, and he didn't catch the last game because of it. And I think wearing down two of your best three hitters was maybe not the best idea for playoff success.
Yeah, Contreras didn't look at all comfortable at the plate batting in that last game even. You know, you wonder if he should have even been in there to have an at-bat. He didn't look comfortable.
He did not.
And it certainly showed up in that game. Well, as we think about the Brewers, one of the things I wanted to go back to was Tobias Myers, and pitching just in general. Now, Tobias Myers had a terrible time in AAA. He had like a 7 ERA or something like that with two or three other teams before he gets to the Brewers, and suddenly he's a great pitcher, or a very good pitcher, and you look at the pitching in general, the Brewers have been known to get people in who weren't doing well, and suddenly they do well when they're playing with the Brewers. So what's going on?
So this is absolutely an organizational thing from top to bottom. A lot of people give credit to Chris Hook, and I'm sure he deserves a lot of it. He's the Brewers pitching coach, but this is an organizational thing from top to bottom. They were one of the first teams, and this goes back to the beginning of the David Stearns era, possibly even before. They built a pitching lab down in Arizona and started to really take pitching, a very scientific approach to pitching. And so they're ahead of a lot of organizations in terms of finding things about pitchers that they are going to accentuate. They'll take the good things that pitchers do and they will accentuate them. They'll ask them to do more of them. They will get rid of the things that don't work. They will tweak things to make things go from, like a pitch, to make it go from good to bad. They're so good at this that they can sort of create pitching depth out of thin air. And you look across the roster this year, Tobias Myers would just be one example of this. Colin Ray was an example of this for them last year. And he was, you know, coming into this year a little bit more established, but he was the same phenomenon coming out of it the year before. You can look around in the bullpen and there's just guy after guy after guy. Koenig would definitely fit that bill.
Definitely.
Yeah, these are all guys that the Brewers have accentuated. We talked about this the last time we were on the podcast earlier this summer, that the Brewers are just among the best teams in baseball at figuring out how to make their players, specifically pitchers, but I think they're getting better on the hitting side at this too, at just making their guys better. And this is what they have to do to be able to compete in a game where, like you talked about, you have very unequal salaries between the top big market clubs and the small market clubs. And so this is the thing the Brewers do so well, and it allows them to compete with the big boys. And I think you can't really overestimate the importance of that, that they're brilliant at this. It's like their core competency. It's what they do best.
Yeah.
So you've got a guy like Chirio. I was thinking about Ryan Braun, Christian Yelich, guys that were really good and then got injured. I just pray or hope at least that Chirio is not going to fall into that hole.
So I don't think, at least immediately, I wouldn't give too much worry to that at all. So the main thing with Jackson Chirio is, first of all, he is at worst the second best prospect the franchise has ever had. And that the only person in contention for that is Yount, obviously is probably the franchise's greatest player. Ryan Braun did not make his major league debut until he was 23 years old. Jackson Chirio turned 20 during this season. So already you are working with 3 years of Jackson Chirio before you even get into the range where Ryan Braun started playing major league, not major league baseball, but the highest level of major league baseball. And injuries really don't, anybody can get hurt, but injuries are really an old man's problem in baseball, and baseball old is not real person old. It's like starts to hit you when you're like 28. But yes. So Chirio, they really have for his true prime, like his absolute youth. They have him signed till I think he essentially is like 29 or 30, right, Ryan? Mm-hmm. So
yeah, they have 8 years and then 2 years of team options that they can add to that, which takes him through his age 29 season.
Yeah. So obviously freak injuries can happen. Christian Yelich broke his own kneecap. Stuff like that is unpredictable. But in terms of soft tissue injuries and things like that, Chirio just shouldn't experience them for many, many, many years. And we should have the absolute best part of his career. And they did a great job signing him taking a risk at signing him to a giant long contract before he actually showed this level of promise in baseball. They all hoped he would have this, but they have him locked up to a very team-friendly contract for a decade. And so this is the best possible scenario you could have with a guy like Chirio.
So let's look at the rest of the players. You know, I remember watching the last game of the regular season, and when Willie Adames, they took him out early in that game, and they got a big hug from Pat Murphy, and it was like that's a goodbye hug, maybe, probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Willie Adames, if they were going to re-sign him, that would have happened before this year even started, and probably even earlier than that. I don't think they ever got all that close to it, and this is going to be a really tough one to swallow because Willie Adames is a fantastic teammate. According to everybody who has spoken about this, nobody comes in less than absolutely raving about what a great teammate he is. And until this year, he had been a great defender too, which made sort of those two things were sort of his hallmarks. And you could then take some offensive ups and downs. And he had some offensive ups and downs. His game is based around power. And sometimes when he's hitting for power, it's great. But when he's not hitting for power, it doesn't work as well overall. But this year, his defense started to fall off in some really noticeable ways. It starts showing up in both visually, you see him making mistakes he didn't used to make, and also in the advanced metrics. And I think ultimately the Brewers are probably getting out at the right time here with Willy Adames, mm-hmm. because he's certainly going to sign a big contract with somebody, and he absolutely deserves it. I hope he gets every penny he possibly can from, I don't know, the Dodgers or whoever. The Dodgers need a shortstop, so go ahead and get every penny you possibly can from one of those teams. But I think in a few years, people are going to be looking at it going, oh, the Brewers probably got out at the right time with Willy Adames, because the defense has already started to show some pretty significant cracks. And he is now moving out of that prime. He's moving into his 30s. I don't think he's quite there yet. I think he's 28, 29 right now. But he'll be moving into his 30s in the life of this contract. And I think you'll expect to see some decline there. So this is going to be a tough one to swallow from a fan perspective. But from a team management standpoint, they already have Joey Ortiz to take his spot, right? So Joey Ortiz is a very, very good defensive shortstop who's been playing third base this year, because Willie was also a great defensive shortstop coming into the year. So they kind of slid him over and said, okay, that's where you're going to play. But Joey Ortiz is ready to be an everyday shortstop at the big league level. So they have the ready-made replacement there.
Yeah. Well, then who plays third?
Well, that is so one of the problems with, so Ryan is right that this is a good time to get out of having to pay Willie. Willie is great, but he crashed on defense really hard. That's often a presage to your offense taking a backseat too. And a lot of guys, when they can't play shortstop anymore, can move and still be effective, but his bat doesn't carry other positions. But just because you're getting out from underneath what could become a bad contract doesn't mean you still don't have a problem. And the Brewers do have a problem, because they only have like 3.5 good hitters on the team, and Willy Adames is one of them. It is a problem coming into next season, and it's a worse problem without Willie's bat. They need to actually go out and get a few bats to fix this. Right now, they're gonna have a really, really poor offense. If they just go into the year with William Contreras and Jackson Churio and half of Garrett Mitchell as their best hitters. And Garrett Mitchell's only good against one side of the pitchers, not the other side. That's why. And so I think that is an open spot right now. I think the Brewers' third baseman for next year is probably not on the team. And so hopefully they go shopping, and hopefully they actually bring in a bat or two to fix one of their major problems from this year.
Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan, the hosts of the Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the Milwaukee Brewers season, and we also need to talk a bit about the playoffs that are still going on with our two guests today, Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan, hosts of the Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast. You can join in at 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. We should mention, before we're out of time here, the series, you know, it's still going on. I hope the Mets lose, but I don't like Philadelphia either. as a fan, I think the most exciting to me, and the games that I have really enjoyed watching are is San Diego and the Los Angeles Dodgers. That series, because they really seem to hate each other.
Yeah, there seems to be bad blood between both matchups in the NLDS this year, because Philly and the Mets, obviously there's a long, long history of antagonism between those franchises, and these are both within the division matchups that they have going on. So yeah, there seems to be no love lost. There was some embarrassment at Dodger Stadium last night with people throwing baseballs onto the field and maybe some other stuff. That's not a good look for the sport, but it also, you know, that's one of those things where it's like, it's a bad look for the sport, but it's also kind of that ratchets up the interest, mm-hmm. and the people are like, oh, there might be like a fight. I need to tune in and see this game. So I think that might draw some eyeballs that wouldn't otherwise pop in on that. But Yeah, I sort of go back and forth. The Brewers have this history of when they have been knocked out of the postseason, they have always been knocked out by a team that goes to the World Series.
Yep, every time.
And oftentimes by the World Series winner has been the team that has ended up knocking them out. And it's really something to watch this happen year after year after year. And one thing that occurred to me was, if that string is ever going to be broken, this year would be a good one, because if the Phillies knock the Mets out, Pete Alonso's home run in that game gets relegated to sort of a side channel of history. If the Mets go on and win this World Series, we will never, ever, ever see the end of that home run. We'll see constantly, forever, and always. And I just would like to get that home run out of my life as soon as possible. So if whatever has to happen, baseball gods, for you to do that, just go ahead and take care of that for us, because I don't need that in my life.
I think we should quickly mention last night, too, in the ridiculous Phillies-Mets game that the Phillies won 7-6, that was an insane game. The Brewer pitcher Trevor McGill's brother Tyler actually took the loss in that game. So our curse is spreading to other places as well.
Well, I thought the San Diego LA game last night was really interesting, when Machado throws a ball into the LA dugout, which very much angered LA. And was it Profar, I think, who faked catching a home run ball? irritated people.
There's been a lot of taunting, yes. And Profar, it was great taunting. We should give credit where credit is due. But it's not good for tamping down the bad blood that exists there. So it's nice to have teams that hate each other playing each other, honestly. Like, it gives a little more oomph to it. If it's two random teams that barely ever see each other, it's not as fun. This is better for sure.
And I really like the San Diego fan base. I've got a friend who was a huge Padres fan. So I'm kind of rooting for them a little bit anyway, just because of him. But that fan base, they've got some really cool things that they do as fans, and they are loud and they never seem to shut up.
Yeah. Yeah, I have a coworker, close friend of mine at work, who's a big Padres fan, and so we talk a lot about that. And yeah, the Padres thing is quite interesting, and they've managed to keep themselves relevant here a little bit longer than I thought maybe they could. So they're going to come crashing down pretty hard in a few years, but for right now they're sort of at the pinnacle. So we'll see if they can manage to get in a World Series.
Yeah, I kind of hope they do. It's always fun to see that kind of multi-billion-dollar payroll go down that the Dodgers have. So this is me as the fan talking here again. I'm rather they didn't. Well, what do you think the Brewers, in the last minute, what do you think the Brewers are going to be like in the coming season?
Well, they had the best rookie class in franchise history this year. By Fangraphs WAR, they had the best rookie class and 15th in the existence of their franchise. So going back to 1969. So I think they're going to continue to build mostly from within. I hope Paul is right that they add some players from the outside, but I don't know how necessarily proven those players are going to be. I think it's going to be a lot more of the same, where they bring in guys and do this development thing with them and try to develop them up, as opposed to bringing in proven commodities. But I think they have a good base to go forward, right, with having this fantastic rookie class led by Churio.
Yeah,
I think I would like them to go get Bregman, but they would definitely won't. So Ryan is correct that it will mostly be, they'll still be good. Like, they have their method of doing things. Their bullpen will still be good. While they will lose Adames, they'll still be a dominant defensive team. And a full season of Churio with an additional year of experience will actually probably mitigate a lot of the offense that they lose. So they'll still be a good team. Their division will probably be marginally better. I think the Cubs will probably get stuff figured out a little bit. And they won't be as pathetic as they were this year across the division. But I think they'll look a lot like they did this year. They'll be very pitching heavy. They'll be very defense heavy. And the offense, Just got to see who comes around and if they actually bother to add a bat or two.
Paul, Ryan, thank you both so much. Ryan Topp and Paul Noonan, hosts of Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast, our guests today. Thanks to them, and thank you for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR. I'm Larry Mueller.